This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by OnX Hunt, creators of the most comprehensive digital mapping system for hunters. Download the Hunt app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. Know where you stand with OnX.
So we're out in the woods, kinda, in your classic, like, close to town, down by the river, people walking dogs, beer cans laying here and there, down by the river spot.
Someone running some kind of...
Hey, what is he doing? Like that kind of spot. Some guy driving some screws into something down there.
Building a stand.
Unclear if he's on his own land or not. And we're in what I would regard as the foraging off season. And we're with Brody Henderson and Chef Michael Hunter. I don't know if you disagree or agree with foraging off season. But by that I mean folks that like to, I find that your general folks that like to hunt and fish a lot have a couple wild edibles they know about. The number one being morels.
I would agree.
So in the spring, you look for morels, yep. And then that ends. And then you kind of act like there's nothing to do until you can maybe go pick a berry in the fall. And that's like the season.
Yep.
So I would put this firmly in the off season, meaning the berries aren't ready.
Yep.
And the morels are gone.
The morels are gone. All like the prime edibles, I would say, are gone.
Easily identifiable.
Easily identifiable. But there's a whole slew of herbs and little plants that are not really, you know, choice, but they're still kind of fun to look for.
And do you tell people just up front, we'll get into this in greater detail later, but tell people up front, like, about your restaurant and what your, like, your food philosophy.
So my restaurant, the name of my restaurant is Antler, and we just want to incorporate all things wild into our menu as much as we can. So we rely heavily on foragers that sell us wild mushrooms, wild plants. We do a little bit of foraging ourselves. We only sell wild, sustainably caught fish, and we sell farmed game meat just because we can't sell actual wild game meat. So we just want to embrace, you know, the outdoors and share that with our customers.
So that rule is the same as it is in the U.S. and Canada,
except as far for as Newfoundland, where they get a little leeway and they're actually allowed to sell wild game.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you buy it from them?
Yep. Well, I think you can. It's dine in. I don't know if you can actually purchase a steak to take it home. And I think it's only certain animals, moose. I don't know what else they're allowed to do. Some ducks and pheasant, upland birds and stuff. But the big one is moose. They have more moose than people in their province. So
gotcha.
I think it was allowed through tourism. It was one of the sort of pushes to get people to go to Newfoundland.
Gotcha. When you walk out, dude, I gotta know what that dude's doing. When you walk out, is he putting up a tree? No. When you walk out this time of year, like you're at a disadvantage because you're from a couple thousand miles away from
here.
Yeah,
so this is not
my typical... So like when you look, are you like, oh yeah, I'm going to tear this place a new one? Or
no,
are you like, I don't know what we're going to find?
I have no idea what we're going to find.
Okay.
And
we saw some dandelion.
Which
is omnipresent.
So right now, like back home when I'm, you know, walking my dog or taking a hike or fishing along the creeks, I'll find stinging nettle, which is incredibly high in iron.
Yep.
So a lot of people make stinging nettle tea. A lot of people put it in pastas. You can make a soup with it. So that's a really neat one. It's really neutral, kind of like spinach. It doesn't have a lot of flavor, but it has more iron than spinach. I think it's more iron than any plant.
Is that right?
Than stinging nettle. So that's a neat one.
It's got more thorns than any plant,
too. It does. So yeah, gloves, like, must. And so stinging nettle, watercress along the creeks is kind of neat. And it's really spicy. Look, the leaves are smaller than the stuff you can buy in the store.
Yeah.
And it's really, really hot and spicy. Wild ginger is out right now. That's a really neat one. It's not actually in the ginger family, but it just tastes like ginger. And it's a root that you kind of have. There's these heart-shaped leaves everywhere, and you got to dig it up. And it has more of like a floral, flowery taste, but it still has that ginger heat. And we use that in ice creams and desserts.
Oh, really?
But you can also make just teas with it. But that's a neat one. What else we got? Sumac, staghorn sumac. It's different than Middle Eastern sumac, but still has that lemony taste to it. So that's sort of almost all year. I think summer's sort of the best time to pick it, because then into the fall and spring, it's kind of eaten and chewed up by bugs and worms and stuff like that.
That's one of the things we have here is, and you might still find it now, but it's getting a little bit late, is oyster mushrooms.
Yep.
Which get ripped up by worms.
Yeah.
And then the dried saddle.
Yep. Pheasant backs are some of my favorite.
Which gets wormed up.
Yeah.
But we saw dandelion. There's mint, wild onion. We'll just have to look around.
Yeah.
I've never actually looked in this spot.
Yeah, cool.
So we'll see.
Let's see what we can find.
What'd you find?
Some mushrooms.
Some LBMs. Little brown mushrooms.
There's a neat one that's called Shaggy Manes.
Oh, yeah, we have those.
Yeah, so those are like golf course mushrooms. They're just randomly around. Those are super tasty.
Oh, what about
but those
that?
Aren't Shaggy Manes.
No, I thought maybe they were because they're starting to curl.
Yeah. But no, we get Shaggy Manes. We get those a little bit later.
Yeah.
Always in disturbed places. What? Like packed down those, ground and shit.
Yeah, I find those just in grassy fields, people's backyards in the city and stuff. It's really funny.
Inky caps.
Yeah.
This is Wild Rose.
Oh, cool.
But doesn't have a, so when later this will have a hip on.
Yeah, neat. Right now we're doing a rose hip ice cream.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we don't have a patio, so our restaurant's still closed. So we're doing all things takeaway, so we're doing a line of wild ice creams right now.
Oh, no shit, really?
Cool. Yeah, so we're doing a rose hip. We're doing a wild mint and chip, chocolate chip, your wild blueberry, and then a strawberry wild ginger.
You ever hear, is there anything to do with horsetail? I never heard anybody eating horsetail. Scouring rush?
I don't know. I've never heard of it. We have I've heard of horsetail, but it looks different than that.
Yeah, we have a handful of kinds. This kind they call scouring rush. It's good for scrubbing pots.
So I think the horsetail I'm thinking of, it looks almost like asparagus. And I've heard you can like pickle that.
There is a stream here, very near here, that has watercress, but it's a private property place. We tried to catch a beaver for a guy, never caught it.
Yeah, like, you know, even all this,
that had watercress in it.
Yeah.
All this dandelion would actually be good unless you're worried about people's dogs. But,
no, shit, I don't care about people's dogs.
Because they don't have, there's no flowers on them. So before they flower, they're not as bitter.
Oh, I think you're post-flower for here.
Oh, really?
These already flowered.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, they flower early here. So, Michael, do you ever eat, you know, like, dandelion's an interesting one because everybody has it. Everybody's sort of kind of aware that you can eat it. But why is it not more popular? That's a horsetail too.
Yes. So that's the ones that I see more of back home. Stuff like this.
In the Cretaceous, these were 80 feet tall. I'm not saying this was, but this is an ancient kind of tree.
Neat. I did not know that.
80 footers, man.
That's crazy.
Dinosaurs gnawing on them. So anyways, dandelions. Like, why? How come they never took off?
Maybe because it's just too common. They're in everyone's backyard.
You don't get excited.
It's not exciting, I think. Unless you like that bitter kind of rapini flavor, it's not really your thing.
So they're better. You're saying that before they flower, they're less bitter?
They're less bitter before they flower.
I didn't know that.
Marsh marigold's another one that's really neat. It grows in swampy creek kind of stuff. And it's really bitter like rapini as well. But that one you have to actually blanch. You're not supposed to eat it raw.
Yeah, that is a bitter green, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to try it before it flowers.
Some of last year's rose hips.
Yeah, there's wild rose. So how do you, when you do rose hips like that, what do you do with them?
So we'll simmer them with the custard. So we'll simmer them with the milk and the sugar, and then whisk them into the eggs, and then we'll let them kind of soak in the custard, and then puree it and strain out the seeds.
I was in Argentina, and they had jars of jam that they were making from rose hip.
Oh, cool, yeah.
But just seemed like a painstaking process to get all that.
Those like seeds?
Seeds. But they got all that outer shell off.
Yeah.
Someone must have just spent hours at it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I like to like boil them and then like crush them up or put them in a blender and then just strain out those.
In September, you'll find grouse that with their crops just
full of those rose hips. And the seeds are like stones. Like they're not even, you can't even chew on them.
See, this right here would be a
good morel spot.
Yeah. Like, big cottonwood. These aren't big, but cottonwoods, especially damaged cottonwoods, down stumps. it's not a hard and fast rule, but there's typically grass.
Yeah.
You know, this would be like a
kind of shady, kind of a little bit of sunlight.
Yep, mixed. I would sniff around in there for sure if I was looking for them.
One of the guys that I was working for came in off his mountain bike. Because this restaurant I worked at was across the street from a huge provincial park.
Uh-huh.
And he came in with a handful of mushrooms and said, here, check these out. And I was 17 or 18 at the time, and I was just like totally fascinated by, you can actually go into the wild and pick stuff, you know? He told me sort of where to find them, and I went across the road on my lunch break and came home with 3 pounds of black mold.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. It was awesome. Then we came and we sold them, we featured them for dinner that night.
No shit.
It was really, really cool, yeah. And those are neat because those are black morels, and they grow, I found them on this like cedar hillside, which is like kind of sandy, mossy soil. And they were just everywhere. They were really neat.
Yeah, when I was reading your bio with your cookbook that's coming out, I didn't realize how early you got started cooking.
Yeah, it was really bizarre. I was a 13-year-old kid, and I wanted to make some pocket change to buy skateboards and stupid t-shirts that said profanity and stuff my mom wouldn't let me buy. And I just wanted my own money, so I rode my bike to this local gas station. I applied to pump gas, and the guy said he didn't need any help at the gas station, but he needed help at the diner. So that's
I'll become a lifelong chef.
I'm in, you know, and it was, started washing dishes. I would fry the hash browns and butter toast. And it was one of those like greasy spoon diners with a lineup out the door on the weekends. And I would bike there at 6:30 in the morning on weekends as a kid. And it was just one of those things. I cooked at home a little bit. I grew up single mom, so my mom would work late. And she would call me and tell me how to start the chicken and stuff like that. So I already knew a little bit about cooking, and I loved, as a kid, I was like always hungry, always like just into food. We'd go to a party and there'd be like oysters or lobster and just things, and I wanted to try new stuff. So food was always a really big thing for me as a kid. And then it just stuck. I worked at a golf course in the summers all through high school. And then when the golf course would close in the winter, I wound up working at this little kind of fine dining country inn. And that's where was like my first real culinary mentor, to say. And then, you know, we made everything from scratch. So we'd make bread, we'd make pasta, we'd make in-house charcuteries and salamis and stuff like that. And that was the fascinating thing for me was the preservation stuff. So how people would survive before they had a fridge, you know, and like there's all this trendy charcuterie stuff people are doing, but it's really just old school. Like it's nothing new, you know, same with hunting and fishing and foraging. Like it's not new, you know, what we're doing. It's just forgotten about.
That's the interesting thing about charcuterie is that now a lot of it seems like all these extra weird things you're doing to end at a product.
Yeah.
And you lose sight of the fact that, like, well, no, this is all, like, shit people came up with, so stuff didn't rot.
Yeah, to survive.
Like, confit, you know, so now,
exactly.
To make a batch of confit then turn around and eat it that night, people would probably been like, no.
Too way too much work.
No, that's, like, for way later, man, when there's nothing to eat, we'll eat that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, we're not eating that shit tonight.
Man, yeah.
It is funny. Yeah, I always catch myself doing that, man. And I have a thing, too, like, just for instance, the other day we caught some lake trout.
Yeah.
And I usually have a thing where first in, first out.
Freezer, yeah.
For freezer management. Yeah. But so I come home with these lake trout fillets.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm gonna freeze them.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, hold on. So I'm gonna put this in the freezer and take some other shit out of the freezer and eat that to reinforce my policy, or would I just eat the damn fish? It's here right now. Let's just eat the fish.
Well, certain kinds of fish
don't freeze.
Well, I know, but I literally caught myself in the freezer door going to put this. I'm like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done.
Eat this now,
I'm like, well, I'm gonna save this for later. Yeah. You know? Just
heard
that pheasant?
Yep, just heard him crowing.
Neat. A very short woodcock migration.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, that's the thing I missed from growing up. Is we didn't put a ton of attention into it, but we would get them.
They're tasty little birds.
Yeah, they're
cool. And the whole
cooking
them with the guts.
Yeah, did you do that? I've never done that.
I did.
Why do people like to eat woodcock guts?
So I think it's just the fact that it's, I think it's one of the only birds, every time they fly, they drop their bowels.
Yeah.
So there's no actual shit in their intestines. And I think it's just, it has that like kind of depth of flavor. It's just different.
Did you enjoy it?
I thought it was interesting. I don't know if I would really do it all the time, but it's sort of like a delicacy.
Do they flush it?
Foie gras.
Because they just eat worms, man.
Yeah.
In old cookbooks, you'd read about eating the guts on woodcocks, but I never knew I couldn't even picture what they're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, you know, how they discovered that, but it's one of those like sort of European delicacy kind of things.
Do you guys call them timber doodles where you are?
No, I never heard that.
You ever see their flight, their mating flight?
No. Oh, well, I know they're hard to shoot. Like they're
they go way up in the air.
Okay.
Woo! Like crazy noises. It's incredible.
That's neat.
It's incredible. We would get them, and they would just come through very briefly, but now and then you'd get into shitloads of them, man. You'd walk into a little kind of like wet, aspen-y area, and just be like bombing out of them.
You hit the migration.
Yeah, then you go back a week later, like, I'm going to get them, and they're all gone.
They're all gone.
I remember eating my first one and being like, holy cow, that tastes like liver. You know, I was like 12 years old.
Taste, man. It is
now I think I'd appreciate it more.
It's not a good one for introducing people.
Yeah, they're funky.
Would you get them in
the funk
growing up?
Yeah. Yeah.
And were you in Michigan as well?
Pennsylvania. Northwestern Pennsylvania near Lake Erie.
I actually just Googled it because I wanted to see how far it was. And it's only like 3.5 hours to drive from Toronto to Detroit, which is kind of neat.
Oh. Yeah, I guess I knew that. Yeah.
Usually, like, I drive to the States more through Buffalo. And even the border for me is only 1.5 hours.
We used to drive up to Toronto because you could drink there when you're 18.
Yeah.
I drank
19.
I drank underage in a Canada bar.
Yeah.
Really? 17. Going,
yeah.
That's Maybe early.
Funny.
Yeah.
I would let my kids do that.
You know, the reason I knew that when I said I knew that is I lived in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan.
Okay.
Which is sister cities of Sault, Ontario.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of kids up there that would go to school and stuff in Toronto.
Right.
And they were always bouncing back and forth.
Yeah.
That's a hunting and fishing paradise.
The Sioux,
That river is unbelievable, man. That's a great fishing river. You guys got a lot of beavers where you live?
We do. Yeah, they can be a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
So we can't hunt them. We are only allowed to trap them.
Yeah, same here.
Unless you're in Colorado, then you can only hunt them.
Causing like damage on your property, then you can shoot them. We had a farmer call us. We hunt deer on his property. He wanted some help getting rid of beavers.
Same here. It's a fur bear.
Yeah.
So you can't hunt it. But here's the thing. They voted trapping out in Colorado.
Okay.
So what's the state doing? They're like, okay.
Hunt them.
Fine. Then you can just hunt them.
Yeah.
Instead. So there. Great.
Yeah. Oh, you should tell them about the beaver sausage you guys made.
Oh, yeah. We did, how many pounds we do?
40.
40 pounds. Hot, spicy Italian beaver sauce.
Have you ever eaten the tail?
Rodent sauce. Oh, yeah.
Tail's good.
I got a couple in my freezer. Yeah, rodent sausage, man. We did put our muskrats in there, but it was going to be a rodent medley.
That's one thing I haven't eaten yet is muskrat. I want to try it. So, yeah, a friend of mine, there's two different kinds of trapper's license. There's like a recreational one where you don't have to have a registered trap line. That's what I'm going to look into.
Yeah, we don't have that. I know you guys have that system. But we don't have a registered trap line system here.
You have to fill your quota and actually take the furs to auction and report your earnings. Yep. And it's very...
If you don't have to have a registered one, what happens when two dudes are like...
Here?
Like if you cross paths.
Dude, it's an honor system.
Right.
Now and then they do it differently. Like for instance, there's a real famous Horicon Marsh in Wisconsin. Real famous, like very valuable high-grade muskrats. And they divide Horicon Marsh up, and then they auction off the rights. But in general, it's just like honor system. It gets ugly.
Yeah.
Even like at the level I trapped, it would get ugly.
Yep.
People were getting fights. I remember being at a fur buyer's one time, and I was young, and the fur buyer saying to another guy on the phone, talking about opening day muskrats, and he goes, "Anybody fucks with you, shoot them." I didn't know he was joking. I was like, Jesus, man, I hope I'm not trapping that spot. But now, I later got to know the guy and realized that he was just having fun. But when you're young and half scared of other trappers, you know. You recognize that?
I don't know what that is.
It's shit on a stick.
It's like a fungus or...
Yeah, black knot.
Yeah.
That grows on cherry. Yeah, we got some friends who are like, I always heard about shit on a stick, but I didn't know it was real.
You guys get cattails?
Yep.
Yeah. So cattails, you can actually eat the shoots in the spring. or you pull them and it's like the root, not necessarily just above the root, there's like, you peel away the outer layer and there's like a nice white kind of
like starchy kind of thing. Yeah.
So you can pickle those.
Yeah, I've taken those and pickled them. That's pretty good, man.
Yeah, pickle cattail shoots are neat. And then I've actually heard of people making, they dry them out and make flour with it, which I thought was really, really interesting.
I've never done that. Yeah. I've heard of that as well.
A bit laborious for me, but.
Cattail right there.
Yeah, there is some old.
Yeah.
Like those, kind of, that looks like it might be
this
year's cattail. Who wants to get wet?
Yeah.
Where are you looking?
Right there.
Yeah.
Go over there and grab that, bro.
You can jump it.
I bet bridge over there.
Bridge.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah,
take bridge.
Candy ass. Embarrassed to call Brody a colleague. He's going to go over and use that bridge. You know, we used to do cattails when we were little. We'd like to...
Hear them? Nope,
we'd like to dip the head in gas.
Oh, shit.
And then light that on fire and run around. And one time we were doing that with the fire chief's kid, and he got real mad, the fire chief.
I would imagine.
It's unbecoming of a fire chief's kid to make cattail torches. What I'm doing is I'm curious now if this is a good crayfish creep.
Yeah, I haven't seen any
raccoon
leavings of crayfish claws and
I smell mint. You smell it? Right here, where I'm stomping.
That's where I
take a whiff.
Good spot to look for it, right by the creek.
No, it reeks of mint. I just can't find it. Someone's in it. Maybe Corinne's in it.
Yeah, it got stirred up somewhere.
There's some kind of plant
overpowering mint odor right now. You smell what I'm talking about?
Now I smell something.
No, do you guys smell it, or is it just
I
mint?
Don't. But.
You don't smell mint right now?
Phantom mint smells aren't a sign of COVID, are they?
Yeah. No, but dude, my mint patch in my garden. I gave away about a bushel of mint last night.
I think they're stomping, on it.
Are you guys stomping on mint?
I don't think so.
I don't see any.
I just got like two big strong whiffs of it.
God, I can't find it. Oh.
There you go, Corinne.
Hold it.
There.
Right there.
Where?
Isn't this mint?
This guy?
No. Oh, that's not a mint? Oh, no, that's not a mint.
Damn it!
Phil, are you walking on mint?
I don't think so.
Michael, do some foragers have the same urge as some hunters to jump a fence like that one over there and go onto private property?
Oh, 100%, I think. Absolutely. If you know there's morels somewhere, I don't think...
Oh, it's tearing me up. Oh. There it is. I found it.
It all stomped. Oh, yeah.
I found it.
Look at that.
There's I found it.
A couple more but under your left arm.
Deep nose.
Is it right in the water?
No, it's just right above the water.
Oh, now I can really smell it.
Now, if someone was smart, they'd dig that up and bring that home.
Oh, see, that looks different than my mint. So we get...
Oh, there's a bazillion there's so many different kinds, right? Man.
See, that one, the leaves are sharp and jagged, yeah.
But that's an odoriferous mint, man. No, hold on. Is that not it? That doesn't smell like mint.
Doesn't taste like mint.
Damn it, that's not really the mint?
I was going to say...
Where is
mine,
it?
Mine has
I thought
red,
that was it with the purple... Because look at that leaf.
The red stalk and the green leaf.
Son of a bitch, that's not
like
it?
Looks like spearmint.
No, that's not it. Damn it. You just said you could smell it real good right now?
I smelled it, yeah. This is bizarre.
It's just thick and there's a lot of shit growing in here. Oh, I thought for sure that was it when I looked at it. It's that purplish stem.
Yeah. Those burrs, whatever they're
Did you find the mint? Do you guys smell it over there?
I don't smell it anymore.
But you were smelling it.
You got a whiff of it, yeah.
No, not that tall.
Okay, I feel like I'm smelling it right now.
I don't think it's on, I think it is on that side. You're right.
Damn it. Sons of bitches.
That's bizarre. It's so strong smelling, we can't find it.
Sitting down here, my nose down on the ground, smelling a bunch of shit.
It must be really small.
Yeah, that's what I'm
it's
thinking.
Not grown up enough yet, maybe.
I feel like that happens a fair bit. Like the other day, we were, not the other day, but a little while ago, we were getting mushrooms. We had several kinds of good mushrooms. And I kept smelling mint and was sort of like like making a half-assed attempt to locate it and didn't locate it. So I couldn't tell where the smell was blowing in from. Find it, Phil.
I'm sorry to report that I did not.
Phil's really pouring the coals to the ground over there.
Should we keep walking a little bit?
Let's do it.
Yeah, Corinne?
I'm trying to find something.
We found all kinds of shit. You want like a major discovery?
You want a meal.
Okay, now that we're sitting here in our beautiful studio, do you kind of see what I'm saying about, like, at least from my perspective, about the off season?
Oh, totally. Yeah,
because the berries.
I would agree.
Yeah, the berries aren't in, and like,
mushrooms are gone.
Yeah, it's not like a hot mushroom time. It kind of starts, you know, gets summertime.
Yeah,
but you can still tell there's like a ton of possibility.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of like hunting, you know. It's every time you go out, you're not going to come home with you know, the trophy, let's say, right? So it's, for me, it's just good to get out there and be in country and hang out with your friends and, you know, hope to find something interesting.
But what it did reinforce is that outside of the big marquee things that people know, like picking, you know, wild blueberries, wild strawberries, whatever, and picking the really nice mushrooms, that there's these two sort of ubiquitous wild edibles.
Yeah, like
dandelion greens and cattails.
Dandelions and cattails.
It's like foraging 101. You know what I mean? Like you're out in the woods starving, whatever. Dandelions and cattails, man.
It'd be a bitter meal, but you could you can make it work.
So later you're gonna Brody here, he's telling me that you guys are gonna like cook something.
Yeah, so I've cleaned up the cattails. We'll use the cattail hearts, and I'm going to do a little dish with a venison loin and a spice ash recipe from the cookbook.
So I've only ever pickled those.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do with them?
I think I'm just going to saute them in a pan with a little olive oil.
Oh, does that work?
Yeah, just saute them. I think you got to clean them really well.
Like get down to the soft stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, just peel out the outer layers, sort of like the last kind of foot of the cattail. You know, not the frilly stuff on top, but the 12 inches of the meaty stalk at the bottom. Just cut that off and then peel the outer layers of the green stuff and you get that white heart.
Do me a favor, though. Do something with the damn dandelions.
We could definitely do a side dish.
Billions of dollars are spent trying to get rid of dandelions. I feel like you have to go and do a neat little salad.
Yeah, you know, a neat little trick, though, is... garlic and chili flakes really kind of take away some of that bitterness.
Oh.
So if you pick enough of them, it's like spinach, like it wilts to nothing. But you steam them or blanch them first, squeeze out the excess water, and then saute it with a little butter, garlic, and chili flakes, and it really just takes away a lot of that bitterness.
Is that right?
Yeah. Like rapini. Same thing, rapini. And one thing I mentioned, marsh marigold is a good one too to treat like that.
You know, I had a little surprise. A negative experience where the lettuce in my garden this early, for us it's still early, mm-hmm, for gardening, didn't bolt.
Okay.
It's early. Bitter is...
Really?
Oh.
Interesting.
Bitter.
I wonder why that is.
Dude, I never... Yeah. And I had one of those seed blends, so it's like 80 kinds of... Yeah, it's just really disappointing.
You don't know what's
man.
What.
No, I feel like the shitty kind did real well in my garden and all the good kind. It's like, you know, it's like 1,000 different kinds of seeds. You just throw it down and take what you get.
Yeah.
Not a good approach, man.
Interesting.
You shouldn't be allowed to do that to people.
Yeah. The bitter mix.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, here's a mix of a bunch of stuff that won't germinate except for the super bitter kinds will be all over the place in your garden and your kids like won't like the salad.
Yeah.
With that behind us, again, Chef Michael Hunter, I hate to do this to you, man. You've probably had to tell the story so many times, but you got to tell the story. You got to start out just for context. You got to tell, I want the story about, you know, when you got super in the news.
The vegans.
Yeah.
The vegans.
Because this will probably like, people will be like, oh, I've never heard about this.
Yeah. That was not something I ever expected was going to happen opening a restaurant.
So that was when you opened?
No, that was it was actually 2 years after we opened. Okay. Yeah, so it wasn't right when we opened, but just not one of the, like, opening and running a restaurant is hard enough. And that was probably the most difficult thing I've had to endure as a chef and a business owner and just as a person, because they were trying to shut us down and, you know, basically just attacking us.
So this is like, it gives people like where you're at.
So my restaurant Antler is located in Toronto. We're just sort of out of downtown. We're in this little pocket called Little Portugal. And we had a chalkboard sign out front. We're a tiny little restaurant. We're 45 seats. And
was that your first restaurant?
The first restaurant that I owned.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
So
I know you'd been in the restaurant biz for a long time.
But so we had this chalkboard sign out front that said, "Venison is the new kale."
And, dude, I had a really nice kale salad last night because my garden kale is kicking my ass.
Kale's awesome.
Do you know Chef? Do you know Jesse Griffiths?
I don't.
He's a chef in Texas.
Okay.
He does a lot of game.
I look him up.
Oh, you should. You guys be like,
they'd be
you guys
friends.
Be like nuts on a dog. He makes this really good kale salad. And I called, texted him to be like, how do you make that shit? And I made mine. It wasn't as good as his. But anyways, it wasn't even kind of like even close to his. I don't get it. But
so venison was the new kale is what did it. And the cyclist rode by and she was a head organizer of a group, like a grassroots organization. I think they have a couple, but it was Pig Save or I forget the actual name of it.
Pig Save.
So they would protest slaughterhouses. And that was their animal rights group, PETA funding type thing. And the organizer of this group rode by on her bike and was offended. And
well, how do you know that happened?
That's what they basically wrote on their site. And then they'd had interviews. So that's how we found out exactly how it happened. And just one night, I think it was in November, they showed up. And we actually got tipped off by a large corporation that they also target. I'm not going to name names, but so this corporation has their own security division that just handles these vegan groups because
that's interesting.
They try and hurt your business.
Yeah.
So we actually got tipped off and they said that this group's coming. Here's their Facebook page. Their Facebook page was private, but they had sort of some intel. I guess they have some fake members of the group.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So we got wind of what was happening. We didn't really think much of it. We just said, okay, business as usual. Let's just try and ignore it. And they sent us a letter of sort of their demands.
Which were?
They wanted to have a meeting with us to change our menu, and they wanted us to put their slogan, you know, one of their slogans in our window.
Oh, but they got a guy to give in and do that too.
Oh, they've got many. Because they're relentless. Like they'll take they take photos of your children and put them online and they just do terrible stuff.
Really?
We had they eventually stopped because a couple of them got restraining orders because they slipped up.
No, that sounds illegal.
Yeah.
So were they? Do you know if they were targeting your restaurant because of its connection to wild game?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. So they said that we were lying to people because, you know, we were hunting and serving the game meat ourselves, and that's not something we've ever, you know, claimed. That's totally legal. You know, the thing with the game farms is I want to sell game because I love to eat it. And it's the only way I can.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of these little game farms are little family run operations, and I know the farmer and we know what they eat and, you know, how they're raised, and we can go visit the farms if we want. And, it's just a really great way to do business for us. So, They call it the humane meat myth. So they were going after small businesses that were farm to table also, because they say that it doesn't matter how the animal's raised, meat is murder. So they say that people are tricking the consumer when they say it's a healthier alternative if farm to table.
Yeah, that's a plausible argument.
I can understand it, I guess.
No, I mean, if like I could see someone hitting on the idea that wait a minute, I don't think you should ever kill an animal.
Exactly.
And sure, if you're nice to it, like, you're still killing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I could definitely see someone arriving at that.
Yeah. But, you know, that animal has a better life than you know, some of the alternative that's out there.
Yeah. But there are arguments floating around out there that I don't get how you arrive at them.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't have to have the opinion to understand how one might get there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it was just baffling to us the way it would happen. So we actually wrote them back once and said, listen, you know, we actually already have a couple of vegan dishes on the menu. You know, vegetarian food and like foraging and just wild ingredients is something that we're really passionate about. We invited them to take them foraging, one, you know, if they were interested, and just have a dialogue. And I think they wrote back something kind of nasty and they didn't want to have – they weren't into that. So we just stopped communicating.
When you wrote them a letter, do you mean you like wrote a letter?
I think it was an email.
Yeah.
It was over email, that one.
So they said to you, they come to you and say, we're going to show up, protest the shit out of your place.
Yep.
Unless you change the menu. And I imagine by change the menu, they mean like full
vegan.
why are they out at your place and not out at Arby's or something?
Well, the funny thing
not
was,
that I'm hacking on Arby's. I don't know what Arby's does.
I'm assuming
they kill all those animals and cut their meat up real thin.
Accidentally outed the butcher shop across the street because I think I said in an interview or something, I said, there's a butcher shop across the street. And then they went and protested them. So I felt bad. But like, seriously, like there's like the meat morgue like across the street, you know, slaughtering more stuff than we are.
Yeah, I've seen the okay, so keep telling the story.
So
I like that deal where they put the sticker in the window. That's bad. I would not want that sticker.
No. No, neither did we.
The sticker basically says, like, assholes working here.
It basically, yeah, meat is murder. I can't remember. It was just bizarre, their slogan. So we just thought, okay, let's ignore this and it'll just go away.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't go away. They were protesting us once a week.
How many people?
5 to 10 would show up.
Oh.
So it was lame. It was totally lame.
What group? What was it? PETA or was it?
No. So it was, they called themselves, it was a Grass Toronto. But there was like several little, the only one I can think of is Pig Save. Cause one of them just actually got run over by a pig truck.
That's interesting.
Yeah. They were protesting.
So it wasn't total like weirdness.
No.
Oh,
so they were protesting.
I thought they were like out checking their mail and got hit by a pig truck. I would find that to be like, I don't know. Like, irony's not the right word.
The only reason I'm thinking of it, cause it was just in the news again, but one of their groups was Pig Save.
And it jumped out in front of a pig truck.
Yeah. They were protesting. They wouldn't move. And I guess the truck didn't stop.
The pigs would eat them.
Pigs would eat them.
My dad always said, if you lay there long enough, that pig will eat you.
And eventually I just got fed up. Well, I would always leave because I knew I was going to do something stupid if I stuck around.
So 5 to 10 people.
5 to 10 people.
And they're hooting and hollering. They're like, hey,
banging
ho,
ho. Banging on our windows, huge signs, screaming at our customers coming in and out. And I was,
Was it bad for business or good for business?
In the beginning, it was bad. And so
I'd have gone in there. I was almost said I would have gone in there, guns a-blazing, as an expression,
yeah.
Not guns. I would have gone in there and had dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had to be there one night. I forget, someone was sick or away and I had to work. And, cause it was just so upsetting. I didn't want to be there when they were there.
Uh-huh. What night of the week was it?
Thursdays. They picked Thursday. They did Thursdays or Fridays. So we get whole deer delivered once a month. We generally get 1 to 2 animals, that would last us the month. And we break down our own stuff. So I went down. We had a delivery that morning. I got so upset. I saw a customer come in visibly on a date. And the woman was almost crying because she's being screamed at with a megaphone. Murderer, like F you. Just horrible stuff. So this woman I saw come in was like almost crying. And I just said, okay, enough's enough. And I went downstairs, chopped off the whole back leg of a deer.
Uh-huh.
Got a red cutting board. I think I got some like sanitizer and stuff so it would be safe if I got called, like if in case the health department were called, I had like safety stuff around me. And I plunked the leg down in the front window and started to just joint and butcher the back leg in front of them. And that was sort of my protest back. Like, you know, you're going to offend me in my window. I'm just going to offend you, right back. And
from within your window.
From within my window. And I had every legal right to do it. But they filmed the whole thing. And the police came in to talk to me because I said, you know, they're calling the health department. I said, that's fine. I'm within my rights. They said, yep, okay. And then, you know, they kind of had a chuckle with me because they were on our side. They were taking police resources away from the city to be there because they're there to keep the peace.
And you guys never called the police on them.
We never called the police on them. They were there to keep the peace because they would bang on our windows and do stuff that is illegal when the police weren't there. So I butchered this deer leg in the window. They filmed the whole thing. I go back, cook up a piece of meat in the kitchen and come back and I ate it in front of them. So that was my protest.
But how did it become like a major, like international news story?
So they they filmed this whole thing, and they sat outside with this big sign, "Meat is murder," as I'm hacking up this.
That's
this
a good album, the meat. Good Smiths album, though, man.
The cover shot is cool.
I go about things the wrong way.
I am human.
Keep going, Steve.
So they posted this video footage to all of their mainstream vegan sites, and it started to blow up and go viral around the world.
But not
in a good way.
Not where you being the hero.
No, not in a good
way. Became the hero.
We became the hero after a weekend of being the devil. So our Google ratings were getting attacked. Our Facebook, anywhere where you could rate our restaurant was being attacked by vegans, giving us 1-star reviews. And, ooh. Oh, I got rotten food and everything you could think of. People started just digging into my social media, pulling pictures of my family, putting them online.
Really?
Just attacking you in every way they could online. And then when the mainstream media got it, so this happened on a Thursday, Friday. So all weekend, this stuff's floating around the webs, and we're just kind of shitting our pants. We're screwed. I screwed us. And then the mainstream picked it up and wrote a really positive piece for us, saying that, we're sticking up for our business. These people have no right telling us what we can and can't serve. We care about our ingredients. We, try and serve ethically sourced stuff. And it was really positive towards us. And just the general public opinion was all in support of Antler. And then it just went viral. I have no understanding.
Was that good for business?
That was. That was. And we were nervous about talking about it because it was, they protested us still once a week for 11 months. They tried to close our business.
You're shitting me.
I swear to God. So it was
tenacious.
It was emotional, man. It was stressful.
They continue to protest you.
They continue to protest. And then, so because it went viral, they got a lot of support on their end too. So these protests of 5 to 10 people turned into 100 outside a little 40-seater restaurant. So it sucked. It was not fun. Afterwards, it's fun.
Why did they eventually quit?
I don't know. They just stopped.
Did you put the sign up they wanted?
No. No, we refused. I said, no, no way in hell. My business partner, I was actually considering it, and my business partner was the one who actually said, no effing way are we doing anything to help, their cause or support what they want. So that was good for me to hear because I was kind of I was getting tired of it.
You're getting ready to capitulate.
Yeah. It was emotional. It was hard. So because we care so much about what we're doing, and it's our life's work, it's our passion. And then to have people trying to physically shut you down and hurt you, was tough.
It's funny how people attack. This happens in a lot of facets of life where people are more inclined to attack something that leans in their direction. When they look at a spectrum of let's say that there's a thing they hate. Okay. So they hate they don't like animal abuse. They don't like violence toward animals. Okay. So that's a spectrum. Oftentimes when someone doesn't like a thing and the thing is part of a spectrum, people want to attack the thing that has the most adjacency to their position.
Right.
Not always, but often. The same way that I imagine you take someone who whatever, you take certain Christian denominations, right? And you'd be like, so they don't like evil, right? So you'd think they would be hyper-focused on devil worshipers.
Yeah.
But they'd be hyper-focused on Mormons. Very, very similar, right? Yeah. But they're so it'd be why are you not mad at devil? I would think that you'd be mad about devil worshipers in your town.
Yeah.
Not people of the Mormon faith in your town who sort of are very in line.
Yeah.
With what you got going on.
They don't deserve it.
but they can't even begin to deal with the devil worshiper
right.
End of things. And so you get something close. And so here you have a restaurant that's sort of saying, you're leaning into ideas of sustainability and leaning into ideas of animal welfare.
Yeah.
And so then they're faced with let's go after the guy that seems to kind of talk about some of the things we're trying to talk about and make an example out of him. How totally. Dare you sort of be, right?
Yeah.
Totally. We have the same problem. It's in a weird way. I always thought we'd get like our company. I always figured, we'll get attacked from the left.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm like, fairly conservative.
Yeah.
Always anticipated that I would get attacked from the left. We get attacked like from the right.
Wow.
Like, you know, you go on TV with everybody's carrying guns around and you spend a career making shows where people have firearms and you promote firearm usage and put it, you know, but it's like, I got a feeling these people don't really like guns. They don't like guns enough for me. And so then you become, you know, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild.
But also it's like, there are many ways to agitate for change. It feels like this is kind of like a manipulative relationship.
Totally.
Where one totally. Makes demands.
Like we're not the ones that make the laws around, because we actually agree with a lot of their beliefs. Like I don't think slaughterhouses are typically a great place for animals to be. You know, and it's illegal for the farmer to slaughter the animal himself and sell it directly to the restaurant. So all animals have to go to this not so great habitat of where they have to spend the last days of their life. So there are things that we agree on, but they should be protesting the government to change the laws to make slaughterhouses a more humane place, I guess.
That's not fun. It's a lot more fun to go out in front of a restaurant and try to destroy someone's job, man.
And, you know, because it went viral, you know, for every 100, you know, supporters we got, you know, they got maybe 2. So, like, their movement grew at the same time, even though it was all negative for them in the mainstream media. You know, they gained a bit of support for their group. So I think that's what, you know, fueled them for so long, is because they were milking it. They were getting all kinds of attention when no one had ever heard of them before.
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't respond to your email back. You know, outreach for conversation.
Invite them to go mushroom picking?
Yeah. So they actually did start responding. And at that point, you know, we had to hire a PR crisis person to help us deal with it. And then so they advise us just to not talk to them at all.
That's what those people always do.
Yeah.
Next time you want to go call a crisis management place, don't. And just be like, I'll tell you what they'll say. Don't engage.
Yeah. Well, it was good because they did steer us in the right direction with some things. It was a friend's company that I knew. So they, you know, it was pretty affordable for us. But they gave us some really good advice because I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to argue with them and try and get my point across. But
did you ever have a sit down?
No. Because they would just publicly post whatever we say, and they twist things. They cut things out. They twist it. They would take pictures of our restaurant at like 5 o'clock before we had any customers and be like, our movement's working. Antler's empty. And it's like, well, yeah, we're not open yet. Like, or it's like, there's like, you know, in between, you know, we have diners come in at 5, 6 o'clock and then another rush at 8. So, you know, there's this weird time when tables are flipping that, you know, there's we're half full. So they'd post these photos. Say Antler's losing business on a Saturday night. You know, they're only half full. I'm like,
did they partially, do you feel that they partially hated you because you embraced it? Like you called it Antler and like you kind of like brace the connection with animals rather than having it be that it's like you have a clown with red hair and he sort of is the face of the.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, a nice clown. He's nice to kids. And they don't talk about what they're serving in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a little, even if there's not an actual connection to hunting, there's like the idea that
we're promoting it.
Yeah.
And that you enjoy
it. That's a good
it.
Point. Yeah. That's a really good
that
point.
That might have been what pissed them off.
Yeah.
Did you get to, did the same group of people show up over the course that you got to know them?
Was it
like,
face.
Hey, yeah. John and Mary, how you doing?
Like, I wouldn't talk to them because I just knew the stuff coming out of my mouth wouldn't be friendly. And I just knew, you know.
But it was the same core group of people.
Same core, same like 5 people, the organizers. Yeah. And especially the ones, because they were the ones taking pictures of my kids and I could see that they were posting them and stuff. So there was one guy that it's like, if I got within 3 feet of him, it would have been ugly. So
yeah.
I was just like, I'm not going anywhere near this.
Yeah, but that's next level low.
Yeah. Incredibly frustrating. Like I didn't have the tools to deal with what, you know, facing them would be like. So I just knew don't go near them.
So it eventually fizzled out.
It just fizzled out, you know.
Did your restaurant maintain the momentum?
We did. We definitely saw like a spike, you know. We were getting phone calls from all around the world. People were emailing us from all around the world. Like literally people sending us the articles from New Zealand, from South Africa, from Singapore, from England in Russian. Like it was just bizarre. Like I had, you know, you see about these stories and things going viral. And then when you experience it yourself is just bizarre. You know,
you have a cookbook coming out.
I do.
Yeah, talk about that.
Very and then proudly.
Tell about the cookbook. But then my question is, did this whole thing sort of put you in a position where you got to do a cookbook, or do you think you would have done a cookbook anyways?
No. So the cookbook was actually what started the restaurant. So, I was working, you know, I grew up working as a chef as a young, you know, teenager.
Yeah. I got started way young.
I got started at 13 at a diner. Yeah. I wanted
to grow up poor.
Not poor. It was sort of up and down. You know, I grew up a single mom, and a lot of times she had her own business. So there were good times and bad times. It was, it wasn't very stable. But I wanted to have my own. I wanted to buy skateboards and t-shirts and, you know, stupid stuff as a kid that your parents would say no to.
So you had to go, get your own cash.
Yeah, and I liked it. I really liked having money. So I thought that was cool. And I liked the work, and I was very food motivated. I loved to eat as a kid. So I found it really cool learning how to make stuff.
So did you ever do any kind of schooling or anything around cooking?
I did. Yeah. So I did, it's a formal trade apprenticeship. So I did my apprenticeship trade, got my Red Seal certification, went to college, a college for trades. I got my chef papers, in my early 20s.
So just career.
Career chef. Yeah. And what really motivated that was, I had my daughter really young. So I had my daughter when I was 19.
Wow.
And, that
How
really
is she now?
16.
That'll date you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm 35.
Figure that out, bro.
So that was really my driving
force. So you had your own restaurant in your early 30s, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It was It's wild. So
working your ass off. You had a kid when you were 19?
I had a kid when I was 19, and that just motivated. Like, I find it does one of two things. Either it motivates you or people run. And I chose to stick around and stick with it. I think, you know, my daughter like saved my life in a lot of ways. Like I had a hard teenage kind of growing up. I was a troubled youth kind of kid, and having a kid really focused me into having an amazing work ethic and just being a solid dude, you know, because I wasn't really solid before.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That you wound up feeling that way. I mean, it's typical, but that's a young age to hit that. I think the older you are, the more likely you'll hit that feeling.
Yeah.
Because I meet some people now and then that don't get that feeling.
Yeah.
the kid having does not
help.
Does not necessarily make one lean in.
I remember a buddy of mine,
Mo, one of our old camera guys, he talked about having a kid, and he said like it made him want to get up in the morning and get like a fedora, you know, and get like a briefcase. And like put your hat on in the morning and march out the door, you know, with your briefcase to conquer the world, man. You know, he's like that's what he felt like he ought to be doing. I'm like, shit, a lot of people don't feel that way.
I didn't have a dad growing up for the most part. My dad moved to L.A. when I was very young.
Where? He moved from Toronto?
Toronto to L.A., yeah, when I was like 3 or 4.
Was he doing? Why did he do that?
He married a woman down there. I think it was just, he himself had like alcoholism problems and stuff like that. So he I think, just wanted to start a new life. And I have two half-sisters in the city as well.
Did he wind up having anything to do with you?
Yeah, so I would go visit him.
Did he write you after he saw the article?
Yeah. No, we're very close now.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'd go visit him on the summers and stuff as a kid.
Oh, okay.
So I think a big part of it was I didn't want to do that to my kid. I wanted to really be there. Is what really motivated me to work hard.
Uh-huh.
So,
that's great.
You know, when a lot of my friends are partying when they're in their 20s, I was working. And that's why I was able to open a restaurant when I was 30 because I was so focused.
So you're getting ready to tell us about how the cookbook led to the...
So, yeah, the cookbook. We got off track there.
No, you're fine. It's all stuff I needed to know.
So I was passionate about food, and I had started hunting and foraging in my late teens. A family friend, I guess I can get into this now, took me out turkey hunting. And because I was cooking professionally... we went turkey hunting, and it was still to this day one of the best turkey hunts I've ever been on. I was so blown away by the flavor of wild turkey because I had something to compare it to. You know, like with deer, you don't grow up eating farmed deer. Whereas, you know, turkey, I'd have turkey at Christmas and Thanksgiving and all these holidays. So it was like eating turkey for the first time. This is what turkey is supposed to taste like. And that other crap that we've been eating from the grocery store, I don't know what that is anymore. Like, that's just garbage. And I think as a chef, you try and source the most amazing ingredients possible. So for me, it was, okay, I don't want to eat that other shit anymore. This is what real food is. is this wild food. And the more I got into hunting and learning about wild foods and foraging, the more interested like my friends and family became, and they wanted me to teach them or take them or talk to them about it. So the idea of the book was really just, I wanted to teach people about hunting and foraging because it's something that I think has just been lost in our culture.
When did you start working on the book?
I think I was 20. I've been working on the book for, and I say week, my business partner got involved. I think I was 27 or 28, started working on the book. I went and bought a camera. And I had worked for a famous chef at the time, and he handed me a cookbook, and I thought, okay, if this guy can do it, like, why can't I do it?
Who was the chef?
Scott Conant. He's out of New York. Okay. But he had opened an Italian restaurant in Toronto.
And he did a cookbook.
He's done a few, yeah. So I worked
for him.
It
can't be that hard.
Well, I just thought, you know, like, Scott was a down-to-earth guy, and I related to him on a lot of levels, and I was like, okay, like, you know, this guy inspired me. It was like, yo, he's got a book. I can do a book. And my sister actually said to me, she's like, you're like the Hunter Chef, because, like, it's our last name. So, and I was like, that's a great name. So I trademarked the name and just, I'm going to write this book and teach people about this. Cause everyone was asking me anyway. I was so passionate about it. And I was like, this is going to be, you know, I want to inspire other people to eat better and eat healthier and learn more about this.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, I started talking to my family about it, and this is what I'm doing. I'm going to work on this book. I bought a camera. I like photography anyway. My sister's, it's a weird connection, but my sister's husband's stepmom said to me, she said, oh, my son is taking cooking classes, and he's a documentary filmmaker. And I'd met him occasionally at family events. And she's like, he's a photographer. You know, you guys should talk. And then we talked, and he was telling me he was taking cooking classes for fun at a local college. And our deal was he'd help me with the photos for the book, and I'd teach him how to cook. And that's how the book started. That was 7 years ago.
And you guys put some time into it.
So we got sidetracked. You know, we started taking photos for the book, and then we thought, okay, let's do some parties. So we do some parties for these food photos. We wanted to make all this food for photos, and then we had all this food kicked lying around. So we're like, well, we'll have a game dinner with our family. So we started having these game dinners, and then we thought, okay, we'll have a game dinner, and sell tickets to it just to pay for some of the expenses. So what we've wound up finding, cause I knew you couldn't sell game in a restaurant, but I wasn't really sure of the laws. Like, you can't sell game, period. So I got a visit from the Ministry of Natural Resources saying that, you know, we can't really do this.
Yeah.
And I had to prove that we didn't really make a profit. Cause we only did one that we sold tickets to, and we kind of got in trouble. So we promoted that. We called it the illegal dinner, cause we were doing it out of his condo and not a restaurant. And, a large paper bought a ticket, and they wanted to write a story about it. And I thought we'd get this little blurb, you know, in this big paper. And we ended up getting like this 2-page spread with photos and this write up about this dinner we were doing, because it was so different. You know, no one does.
And
that
got
like
you
this. That got me a visit from the Ministry of Natural Resources. Came to visit, and then we, you know, they were very, very nice, but I had to provide receipts because we had bought rentals. We had to rent plates and tables and chairs, and, you know, we did this little dinner for 15 people. We had to buy a lot of food.
So at the time, you were just ignorant of the rules about it.
I was ignorant of the rules. Like, there's, because in Canada, there's, well, at least in Toronto, there's two laws. There's the Ontario Public Health, where you can't sell meat that hasn't been through a slaughterhouse.
Yep.
And then there's the wild game laws, which I was unaware of, that you can't sell game for profit at all. Like, yeah. You know, even to your neighbor, you know, whatever.
Yeah, we have a very similar suite of laws down here. Yeah.
So now I know.
The interesting thing about talking, you know, I don't know if this is reciprocal, but like, many people in the U.S. view Canada as being like almost like a facsimile.
Yeah.
And then when you're talking about the rules, yeah. Earlier we were talking about like gun laws. I'm like, yeah. That's right. It's a different country.
Very different. Yeah. So a lot of the game laws are really similar. But yeah. The gun laws are totally different. And we could spend quite a while talking about that too. We started getting all this publicity around this book that we're doing and this idea of wild food. And the restaurant where I was working, they said to me, they said, hey, you know, we noticed this article in the paper. Said, we don't really want to be involved in this. Like, if you do stuff on your day off, that's fine. But like, we don't want to be mentioned in these articles. And so we kind of thought, well, you know, this, we're getting this promotion. It's not going
back
anywhere.
Up. I'm confused. The restaurant where you were working didn't want it to be known that you worked at that restaurant.
Not because they didn't want to be associated with hunting. Because they even said to me, we don't want vegans protesting our restaurants. They called it. They called it.
Really? They just had a feeling.
They just said, we don't want PETA outside. So they just said, if you're doing this hunting and foraging, fishing stuff, like, that's great. But we don't really want to be a part of it. And that was a big thing. It was hard for me as a chef because I wanted to serve game dishes in the restaurant. And, you know, they didn't really want to. So a big part of Antler was just me being able to cook what I wanted to cook without anyone telling me no.
So when you go to do a restaurant, is that like financially, man, that's risky, right?
It's very risky. I think it's like 50% of restaurants fail within the first year of business.
What causes that?
It's a lot of mismanagement of money, and it's a lot of, there's, you don't need a license to open a restaurant. Like, you need a business license, but you don't have to actually, you know, take a business course or be licensed as a chef. You don't have to have like a chef license. I do, because it was my choice to go and get it. But like, if you want to be a hairdresser or a barber, you have to go to school and do safety course and get a license to be a barber. Whereas the restaurant industry, you know, at least in Canada, it's a little different. So there's a lot of people that are just going and opening restaurants because they think it's a good thing or idea to do, and they don't necessarily take the business courses that go along with it.
Yeah,
I think. And
but when you hear about the failure rate on restaurants, is it because they're assuming that every seat's going to be full all the time, or are some of them so mismanaged that even if every seat was filled all the time, you still wouldn't be okay?
I think it's a little bit of both. And, you know, you're dealing with product that can go bad. You're dealing with like a party scenario. So if people are treating it like their own personal party, having their friends over and drinking and giving away free food, can be the case. A lot of it's just like managing of the business itself. So we actually learned that we actually have to overbook our restaurant because of the amount of people that don't show up. So because we're so small, you know, if we fully book ourselves at, you know, we say we were going to do two turns a night, so flip the table twice. So say we book 80 people. Well, if 20 of those people don't show up, that's a huge lack of sales that we could have had. So we actually have to overbook and take into account, because stuff happens. People get sick or they forget or whatever it is. So people don't show up. So you have to account for that. There's tons of stuff like that. Theft is huge, you know, because you're dealing with food and booze. People like to eat and drink. So,
I mean, theft from employees.
Theft from employees.
And then
sometimes
you got robbed three times in one year. Yeah.
That's been a problem. Yeah.
Like people, old fashioned theft.
Old fashioned. Smash in the window, run in, grab as much stuff as you can and run out. So there's that. You know, fortunately, it doesn't happen a lot. And they didn't really steal very much. But that, you know, that did happen.
When does the book come out?
October 6th.
That's a good looking book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Did you have the recipes all figured out when you started and when you were 27, or was it a work in progress?
No, it was a total work in progress, and things changed even up to, like, you know, the very last date I had to get stuff into the publisher. We're like, okay, we're going to tweak this and fix that.
Yeah.
And there's still, like, you know, another 50 recipes that now I'm like, oh, I want to put that in there, and it's too late.
How many did you get in there?
There's 100 recipes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're really excited. It's I think four main categories. There's fish and foraged, there's small game, large game, and then there's a dessert and cocktail section, which is really cool.
Cool.
That's really fun, yeah.
Tell people some of the kinds of things you serve at your restaurant.
So we like to incorporate all things wild, you know, things that you'd find in Canada and the United States. So wild mushrooms is a big part of that, chanterelles, morels, black trumpets. You know, if I go foraging, we'll take those pheasant backs we spoke about and shaggy manes and some of the other kinds.
And you buy that from, you'll buy mushrooms from professional pickers.
Yeah, totally.
And what's that industry look like? Like,
it's a neat
one. Just kind of like, they just show up.
Yes and no. Like, some of them show up and I'm a little sketchy around those people, but a lot of times we'll get emails, or there's some bigger ones that are more well-known that I've used for years. You know, they pick themselves and they also buy from pickers. So, cause they're in Ontario, we buy BC mushrooms. And it's an interesting market, and the thing is, stuff's expensive.
And there's no rule against someone, like, just Joe Blow, right? Just any dude off the street can show up and bang on your door with a sack of morels.
Yep.
And you can buy them and serve them.
Yep. In some places, it's not. Like, I've heard of other states and provinces where they cannot go to a farmer's market and buy food. They have to buy it from a licensed supplier. We don't have those laws where I am. But so I hear they do exist. But just
do you
not
do transactions like that?
I have in the past. Yeah. Some people have shown up and they've had beautiful ramps, or they're also called wild leeks, for instance. Yep. And they say, you know, these are huge patches at my cottage. Are you interested? And they're beautiful. And I said, yeah, sure. You know, here's $100 or $150 and whatever. We got this bushel of ramps. So it does happen.
Then you turn around and put them on the menu.
Turn around. We have to clean them and chop them up and all that stuff. But yeah, we turn around. I love those ingredients because you can't find them in a store.
Uh-huh.
And they just taste so much different than anything you do find in a store. So even some of the mushrooms that things you can buy in the store, when you buy them or you pick them yourself, there's more of a connection to it, but they're just fresher. They taste better when they're like 2 or 3 days old versus the store. You don't know how long it's been in there.
I was talking to my kids about this the other day because the difference between the strawberries that we grow and the ones you buy, I don't understand what goes wrong.
Why are they huge?
Why are the ones in the store, like, they're the size of an apple and taste like nothing? Like, I don't get, like, if you told me, how is it easier to grow one that tastes real good?
I don't know.
Like, if you told me to grow like a shitty strawberry, I wouldn't know where to begin.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime I've ever grown them, like growing up, I had them. I've had them in a couple of houses where we started strawberry patches. They always are good.
They're the little tiny.
So what, but like, what is it? How do you, why is it so hard to make a bad strawberry? And why are there so many bad strawberries for sale? But I'm saying, like, even things you can get in the store aren't as good.
Tomatoes are the same way.
Oh, man.
Well, I mean, GMO, like you have,
I don't think
like
it's that.
Arctic fish. Combine, like, introduced to strawberries to make shelf life longer.
That's gross. It's
yeah. Oh, I mean GMO being that you can do that to wind up having strawberries that live forever,
right?
Yeah.
And taste like shit.
And they're probably, like, you know, I've heard of, like, they gas them, they do all kinds of things to make them turn red, and, you know, who knows?
You gotta wonder if hydroponic stuff hasn't fit, like, not being in the earth,
not pulling as much flavor.
Crop rotation, like, if they're just planting the same thing over and over and over and over and over again in that same soil, like, how's it gonna taste good?
Yeah,
I don't know.
All the above, man.
Yeah.
God, strawberries taste good when you make them yourself, though.
Anything that you have in your own garden, or you, like, it's, you know, you pick a straw, like a tomato, like you said, and it's warm from the sun, and then you cut that up and just put salt on it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredible, you know? So I think, you know, as a chef, that search for the purest ingredients is really what led me to hunting and foraging and fishing.
What do you do for fish in your restaurant?
So we only sell wild fish, and it's only from, you know, Canada. We're lucky. We have the Great Lakes. So there's perch, there's whitefish, you know, rainbow trout, and then, you know, the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and the Arctic Ocean. So we have, you know, Arctic char, you know, halibut, salmon, rockfish, you know, crabs.
You guys will sell perch?
Yeah. I love perch.
What do you do with the perch?
Either fry it or, you know, just, you know, 2 or 3 fillets for an order kind of thing. But I like frying it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spot prawns. I love spot prawns. They're incredible.
And what do you guys do with the venison you have in your restaurant?
So we do a couple of different things with venison. One's really fun. We put it in our burger meat. We do a mix of that, though, of wild boar, bison, and deer.
Okay.
We do these venison patties, which are really cool.
What do you put for fat in there?
So for the burger, it's the boar. The farmed boar is kind of fatty, like pork.
Got you.
The meat's still different. Like, the meat's very dark. And then our kind of like a, it turned into a signature dish. We do venison two ways. So we do a stew with the neck and the shanks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pair that with a steak from one of the primal cuts. And then with that, the steak, we do an ash spice, which is this really kind of flavorful, sweet spice. We do cinnamon, star anise, juniper, and cloves. And then we toast those till they're super dark and black. And then we grind those up and then put them through a sieve to get all the large chunks out, and this really fine black powder.
Hence the ash.
Hence the ash.
Yeah.
And we roll that, you know, the steak in that, and then, just sear that nice and rare. So it's cool when you cut it. It's got like a black line and then red. And then that goes on the stew. which is kind of neat. So because we, like I said earlier, we buy whole deer, so we get all these offcuts. We have to figure out something to do with.
When do you go to buy a whole deer from a deer farmer? What is the cost of that?
They're, I think it's like $8 a pound. Or yeah, he charges $8 a pound.
When you're saying deer, are you saying red deer?
We're buying red deer. So they're bigger. They're about, we're, you know, clean.
Like our elk a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. They're very similar in size. So we're getting those deer. They're anywhere from 120 to 150 pounds.
And they'll charge you like $8 a pound for that.
Yeah. We got to break it down.
Including the bones.
Yeah. So there is a lot of, and then we make stock with the bones and, you know, we don't waste anything. So we use every little scrap of it. It's really neat.
Earlier we were talking about, we got on the subject of restrictions that you deal with in Canada. And we talked about emerging gun laws. Like, you're kind of vocal about this, right?
I'm very vocal about it because it's affecting me personally. And the gun laws aren't doing anything to help crime, which is a problem.
Because that's the thing, like a thing that people are aware of, I think that, like, you know, talk about this sort of like perception of, if you're in the U.S., you have a perception of what goes on.
Yeah.
People are aware, like, oh, Canada, you know, their gun laws.
They suck. They're terrible.
But what is it?
So,
like, what can you, let's say you just want to, let's say you're a Canadian citizen.
Yeah.
And you want to go out and just buy, you want to buy a rifle.
Yeah.
You want to buy a deer rifle. Put a scope on it. Bolt action rifle, put a scope on it. Do they make that difficult?
Yes, it's difficult. You have to do a safety course, which I think is a good thing. But after you do that safety course, my wife just waited 7 or 8 months to get her license in the mail. And it's only supposed to take 45 days. So there's like a 45-day mandatory waiting period, which, sure, maybe that's a good thing. You're pissed off. You just do your safety course. You have a grudge or something, and you have to wait 45 days to go buy a gun. Maybe
you get so mad at someone, you go down and take your safety course.
I hope I'm mad for 45 days.
So, like, I think
you got to put a note on your fridge. Stay mad at Bob.
So I think, you know, there are some common sense stuff, like a safety course. Sure, that's a good thing. I think everyone that owns firearms should have to take a safety course.
Dude, that wouldn't fly here.
No, but because the problem is that once they pass those laws, like, we don't have a right to own firearms in Canada. So I think that's the problem.
Yeah, there's no, that's what you're saying. Like, you wish that you had an equivalent of the Second Amendment.
That's the problem, because
so they never, like, codified anywhere.
No.
That to some extent you.
No. So it's a privilege.
There's no opening. There's no, like, there's no sort of foundational understanding.
So in no situation can you roll down to the gun shop and walk away with one.
No. Now, once you have your license, your non-restricted license, you can.
Okay.
Like pistols and ARs. Well, ARs have just been banned. So.
But walk me through, because I want to get to that bad. But walk me through the first, like.
So to get a rifle, you have to do a safety course.
It's like, does that involve proficiency?
No. Well, you have to handle some dummy firearms that have had the firing pins removed.
Okay.
So safety, you know, working the action, loading, unloading, you know, dummy bullets, all that
stuff.
And
how long does it take to do the class?
It's a weekend course. Like two.
So it's kind of like going to hunter safety.
Exactly.
And then they're like, you are now a safe person. And they hand you and then they mail you a thing.
They mail you a thing, you know, 8 months later.
Is that course, like, is it cover long guns and handguns, or is it specific to a type? Or?
So that is specific to long guns.
Okay.
So that's anything over 18-inch barrel, I think is the 18.5-inch barrel. So that's, you know, your shotguns and your bolt actions, you know, break action, stuff like that. They just show you, they have the different styles of firearms on the table, and they teach you how to work them and unload them and all that stuff. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. But where the issue is now they've created all these new laws and they're taking away people's property that aren't part of the problem of what's going on. So, we have gang shootings in the cities. These people aren't following rules. They don't have licenses. They don't go into stores and buy guns. But that's the perception for people that don't own guns. Like, when COVID hit, gun stores were actually posting that people are going to gun stores trying to buy a gun because they're worried about looting and being unsafe. And then they get laughed at by the store owners that say, you need a license. And they're like, what?
They weren't even aware.
People aren't even aware. Like, it's just the perception that, oh, you know, to get a gun, you just go buy a gun in Canada. And that's not the case.
So criminals, they're not like, dude, I'm fixing to commit a crime, but I'm waiting for my.
Yeah. Waiting for my license. Yeah. So that's where I take issue, is because they've recently banned over 1,500 different firearms in Canada. And criminals, they're not going and getting a license. They're not registering these guns. And they're committing the crimes. And it just sucks. And I'm personally losing some weapons that I've – or firearms that I've hunted with.
Like you'll need to go down and hand them over.
That they haven't worked out the details yet because this is so new. It happened on March 15th. But that's in 2 years, we have a 2 year amnesty where we can either hand them over or they're going to grandfather them, is what they've spoken about. But that's not, there's no details yet.
How, with you owning a restaurant, is that your primary like livelihood? Is that
yes.
Your yeah. restaurant's your is primary that, livelihood?
Yeah.
How tied in, like, let me give you. McDonald's. I don't know the first thing about the CEO of McDonald's.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what he thinks about anything.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the most people, it's safe to say, most people that go to McDonald's will go there with no knowledge of what McDonald's stands for politically.
Yeah.
In fact, people will, when I was earlier talking about getting an attack for various things, you know, we'll always hear from people on social media like, hi, I can't believe you would, you know, associate with such and such because they're not this person, they're not pro-gun enough.
Yeah.
I'd be like, who made your phone? Like, yeah. You're typing this on a phone. Tell me about the CEO of the phone company that you're using. Like, are they, do they pass your muster? Yeah. Right. So do you find that people, will suss out with your restaurant, like, oh, here's a person who's vocal about gun rights, and then reward or punish you? Or is it like, or is your sort of social media self like very different from your restaurant self?
I definitely keep it separate, but what, you know,
is like, it risky like you said, for you to engage in cultural?
I think, yes, it is for sure. And it's something that my business partner is very concerned about. So,
like he's like, ixnay on the uns gay.
Yes. We had several chats. So yeah, like, you know, I try, you know, the opinions expressed are my own, like that's on my Twitter. So it has nothing to do with the business because there's a lot of other people at the business that run the business, you know, and it's not fair to punish them because, you know, I'm in Canada pro gun, let's say, but, you know, but the big problem is our judicial system, and they're not punishing these criminals that are committing these crimes. Like, someone's caught with a gun in their. So let's talk about restricted guns. So that's pistols and semi-automatics with a shorter barrel.
Uh-huh.
So in Canada, for me to transport my pistol or for me to use my pistol, I have to have a separate license, which is called a non-restricted gun license. And then the only place I can shoot that pistol is at a gun range. And then if I want to transport that pistol, I have to have a trigger lock on it and then in a locked case. So it's double locked and the ammunition is separate. That's our laws for pistols. So we have people walking around the streets of Toronto with pistols in their pockets that aren't double locked and loaded, and they get arrested and they make bail and they're out on the street in 2 days or 24 hours. They're on bail walking around again.
That's what I think frustrates a lot of people about when you get into the gun control debate is it seems that the same the same sort of political persuasion that would favor restrictions on firearms, not seems, this is like generally true.
Yeah.
An individual inclined toward restricting access to firearms probably, not even probably, like is inclined toward not punishing crime.
Yeah.
As.
Yeah, it'd be like, I want to make more things illegal, but do less shit to people who do illegal things.
It's unfortunate. And the other thing is unfortunate is, you know, I have these views about guns because I'm a hunter and I use guns. But so then I'm like a far right extremist all of a sudden. Like my wife got chewed out at like a family party by like one of someone's neighbor. Oh, your husband he's so right wing all of a sudden. And it's like, I'm not necessarily right wing. I have some right wing views. I have some left views as well. Like
confusing. It's too confusing, yeah, for people.
It's like I'm pretty middle road with a lot of stuff, and yeah, and it's just funny because I'm a hunter and because I have these views about guns. Now I'm this right wing extremist all of a sudden, and I'm like, well, it's not really true, not true at all.
Well, as far as Save a Pig goes, you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just they put weird. You there.
Yeah, it's I know it is a little bit painful like that, and it's winds up being a thing. I don't think it's going away anytime soon. This idea that there's all these litmus, there's like these litmus tests, and depending on a person's sensibility, they all have varying litmus tests, but they'll take like your stance on X and then extrapolate out from there to make a bunch of judgments about how you feel about a ton of things.
Yeah.
And different people use different litmus tests. You know, you could ask someone a question, like you could ask someone a policy, you know, like a policy question. Your answer to the policy question would then indicate, you know, that you're a racist or not a racist. He's like, but hold on, I thought we were talking about a specific policy question.
Yeah.
Or that, like, how do you feel about firearms? If you sort of look at the legal structure and you're uncomfortable with restrictions on firearms, that they want to then sort of like neutralize your voice by painting you into some kind of like radical element where nothing you say can be trusted because you're radicalized.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate the degree to which that's starting to happen. I'm sure it's always happened a bit, but it seems to be happening more and more and more now.
It's like the divide
where
is
you
growing.
Become, yeah, you become, it's more likely to be that you'll be crucified for some portion of what you think.
Yeah.
But crucified on a wide scale level.
Oh, like, made to pay in a wide way.
Yeah.
I find myself running the other direction of it, man, and trying to be more, even things that I'm like personally that I feel really strongly about, you know, land issues and conservation issues and habitat issues. Right. Even when I hear someone that would say something that violates my like deeply held feelings about it. And I'd be like, I would normally think like, what you just said is evil. I will now assume that you're evil and everything about you is evil. I'm like, hold on a minute, man. Don't do to this guy what you would hate to have done to you.
That's a good point.
You know, and they'll say, I think the government should give all that land up. No one should ever go on it ever again. I'm like, all right, man, you know, you're probably a good guy. So let's talk for a minute about that and not commit the same thing that I hate.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's very mature.
Well, I don't know.
It's hard.
I'm halfway to 90. Yeah. The fact that I eventually got to a point where I would like try to attempt to engage with people in a debate the way that I would like them to approach me.
It's hard to be a nuanced thinker, I think. You know, it's like,
well, it's not encouraged politically.
Oh, definitely
anymore, right?
Not at all.
It's one or the other.
You know, do I judge you to be on my side or not? Are you a threat to me or are you safe for me based upon whatever my own individual calculus is of that? And I think that really undermines all of us.
I just got a friend of mine emailed me an article late last night. It's in the papers now. That the Museum of Natural History in New York was like, oh, you know, we're taking down our Theodore Roosevelt statue. And the statue in question is like Theodore Roosevelt. He's like up on a horse, sort of, you know, it's like a very virile conquering horse thing. And to sort of behind him walking is a Native American on one side. And I don't know if it's I shouldn't say an African American, someone of African descent. On his other side, kind of walking behind him while he's up on this horse. And you look and it's sort of like he's, I don't know, leading the charge. Whatever the hell. Leading the charge. I look at it and my initial, like, I go through all these things where I look at it and I'm like, and I was pissed, right? At first, because I'm thinking, well, how now are we going to throw out the father of American conservation? You know, are we done with that now? Like, he was so contextually... He was so ahead of his time that most politicians haven't caught up with the guy 120 years later. Like a real controversial putting his neck out for wilderness and wildlife. And so then I'm like, are they really going to piss that away? But then like read the article, which is not what I didn't read it till the next, I got all mad. Then the next day read the article. It turns out they're going in and naming in the museum, they're actually naming extra shit after Roosevelt. They're doubling down on Roosevelt. They're just saying this particular statue is problematic. Like, this depiction is problematic. Do we think that the man is problematic? No. In fact, we're going to go name more shit after him. His father was like a founding member. He has this like great history, but you got to get down to the bottom of the article to get there. But I was already too pissed.
Yeah.
Because the headline.
Right.
But Roosevelt also has some things you got to question too. Things that viewpoints that he held, you know?
Yes, so is Abe Lincoln.
Well, I get that. I'm just saying.
You're never, Brody, you're never going to kill them all.
Oh, I know. I'm not saying that's not my goal. I'm saying that people are just more aware of.
Sure.
That type of thing.
This is way beyond the scope of what we talk about on this year's show.
Yeah, we can go back to food.
Real quick. I want to go back to food. But real quick, man. I'm going to choose my words carefully here. I get very uneasy around applying a modern lens in all cases to people who, to individuals who, especially individuals who at the time were beginning to poke holes in and question the thing that they're now being condemned for. And the positioning in front of the Natural History Museum, the Natural History Museum isn't called the Colonialism Museum.
No.
It's about a commitment to conservation.
Yeah.
I feel like if I was involved in that debate, I'd be like, oh, I don't give a shit. Take that one down. Let's put up a different one of the same person there.
Right.
Like I don't care about like this particular, you know what? That statue, I don't know if you caught this, Corinne. That was made by the guy who carved the buffalo head nickel.
Oh, no, I didn't. I was literally...
James Fraser.
Okay.
He did the buffalo head nickel off a buffalo in a buffalo in a zoo in New York. People were real disappointed with his nickel. But he, it's kind of like everybody thought it was like a shitty looking, morose looking buffalo. But same sculptor that did this Roosevelt statue in question. It's like, maybe I'm naive or whatever, or I'm like juvenile, but I think that like certain heroes are helpful to have.
Sure.
I sit on the board of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, which puts its ass on the line all the time, you know, for wildlife and habitat. So now is it like, are they bad?
No. I don't think I was ever saying that.
I don't think you were either. I'm talking to like the air behind you.
There's, you know, optics that are being exposed these days that people are questioning. You know?
Here's part of a press release. So while the statue is meant to celebrate Roosevelt as a, quote, devoted naturalist and author of works on natural history, the statue also, quote, communicates a racial hierarchy that the museum and members of the public have long found disturbing. So I understand how folks who disagree see the Native American and African man flanking Roosevelt as modeled in a position that's subordinate to him. And I can also understand how folks might see them as proxies for people of color today. Symbols can be very powerful. If we look at the origin of the word monument, it literally means calling to mind, like something that reminds. So I recently heard this interview on NPR with a historian who was addressing Confederate statues, and he offered up what I thought to be a unique idea in addressing them. And he was saying that he thought the statues should stay where they are, but come with, I think his wording was, come with a footnote of epic proportions. So what I took that to mean was that there was some kind of an additive process. So you'd keep the statues where they are, and either with a placard or, you know, you can take a lot of artistic license in representing something additive to the statue to put it in context and to kind of address its place in time as we see it today.
Yeah. Or here's another fix. Have someone make his compatriots on bigger horses.
Honor them.
With put them on Pegasus, like winged horses that are way bigger than Roosevelt's horse. I don't care. I'm just reluctant to the amount of people who've been inspired by him and what he did, the amount of people that have been inspired to engage in the environmental battle and to engage in wildlife conservation have been inspired by the image. Watch the how much damage are you how much damage are you inflicting to people's understanding? I'm not the guy to make up these. I'm not the guy to answer these questions.
Well, it's like what we were talking about earlier. You know, it's like picking one issue. Like you can't. Whatever the guy was like, he was still a great conservationist, right? Like that's a fact.
Yeah, but man, beware the teeter totter. Now, that's not the word I'm looking for. What's it called when something swings and comes back?
The pendulum.
Beware the pendulum. You're gonna move away. You were talking about moving away from where you live now.
I don't know. I'm going to have to consult my wife with that one, but it's hard because
I feel... Is it just too hot in Toronto? I mean, hot, like politically hot.
It's getting a little politically hot. You know, we do have our sights on BC where she's from. It's a mecca for hunting and foraging and fishing out there. I have lots of friends there and you know, it is a dream to open a restaurant there one day, for sure.
If you factor in... the trouble with the vegan protesters, the animal rights protesters, issues around firearms and stuff that you might get in trouble for. Do you find that it's generally been advantageous to self-identify as a hunter and to be vocal about that from a business standpoint? Or do you feel like you would have especially kicked ass if you hadn't been so vocal?
I don't know. Like I think I was just raised... to, you know, be yourself. And I just like, I cook what I want to cook. I say what I want to say. You know, I, you know, in terms of food, I just hope people enjoy it. And, you know, your customers are the critics, you know, with food. But my voice, you know, I do my best to try and keep it separate from the business as much as I can. But, you know, we do get a lot of hunters that come to talk to us about hunting. And we get a lot of guys that come and say, you know, I've never had a deer steak taste this good. You know, you got to give me the recipe for the spice or whatever. Or,
yeah, that's cool.
You know, it's really, hunters will come and bring me hats from like their Ducks Unlimited chapter or whatever it is. And it's cool. You know, we certainly get a connection with a group of people we may not have had a connection with if there wasn't the hunting aspect to the business.
Who came up with the idea to call it Antler?
That was a group decision. So there was supposed to be three partners. One ended up backing out because they were having a baby. I didn't want to risk it. But my business partner, Jody Shapiro, and I, and another friend, we had a, you know, big whiteboard and 300 names on there. And
okay.
We were just, you know, picking and choosing. And
did you guys ever consider like big, huge Antler?
Yeah. I forget some of the earlier names. We've actually got some photos of the names. Like there were some funny ones. But Antler was supposed to just represent also like a shed antler on the ground.
Yeah.
And we actually have one on the restaurant wall when you walk in. It was from...
Yeah, if it was Antlers, it'd be different.
Yeah, it's just from Jody's Cottage.
Well, there is a place called Antlers in the UP.
I've researched and found
out. Do you have a bunch of like mounts and stuff? Or is it like at the hunting lodge only feel?
One.
Or?
There's only one. So we didn't want it to be like super hunting lodge. We just wanted it to be like cabin in the woods feel. So there's my first buck... Euro mount that I did myself on the wall above the chef's table. And then there's the single antler when you walk in. We have a couple more new additions. There's a black duck now. My friend shot, he was moving and he was like, here, take this. I don't want to move it. So we have his, it's this beautiful black duck mount on the bar, above the bar. And then what else? There's a couple like some pheasant feathers, I think, tail feathers coming out of a vase somewhere. But it's not like super in your face.
Yeah.
We shoot things.
How much does it cost? You probably know this in US dollars. Like, what's the cost to go eat in your restaurant?
It varies. So like we have a burger that's, you know, $18 or something. Like it's not, you know, it depends what you want. Like you can have, you know, a burger and a beer and leave for, you know, under $30 if you want. Our bison ribeye, those things are a bit more pricey. I think that's like $45. Just because like the game stuff is also a bit more expensive than the run of the mill. Or even like nice beef, are the bison's always more.
Yeah.
More money just for me to even buy it. So.
Do you feel like your restaurant is also a place where people come in and ask you questions about game and hunting and
totally.
Learn a thing or two?
Yeah,
you know,
it's neat.
Like
we a lot of people eating game for the first time. Like we had chicken on the menu when we first opened, like just in case someone on the date didn't want to eat deer, you know, and we just end up eating it all the time. So before it went bad, because no one ordered it, you know, people were coming to try new things. And then we have a lot of fish too. So if people aren't into red meat or game, they have fish. So, and that's something I love. And we joke around it all the time. I wish I could sell more fish. And then I was like, you know, hurting on the servers one day being like, you know, guys, why can't you sell the fish? And they're like, I don't know, dude, you named your restaurant Antler. Like, can't help you, man. Like, so we have a couple fish dishes, but I would love to do more. But it's just not what people are coming for.
Do you guys do any like butchering classes or anything like that?
We're too small. Like I would love to. People do ask me all the time. And it's like, I also have two kids and my wife, and it's, you know, it's hard now finding that balance between, you know, being a chef and having a family.
Yeah. Do you ever get
so you have a second kid after the one that you have when you're 19 or two more?
No, I have two kids. So, but yeah, so my son was just born 6 years later. So there's 6 years between them. Yeah.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. When do you get time to hunt and fish on your own?
So now, just because we opened the restaurant and it really, we stopped working on the book. So we thought, okay, we'll have the restaurant, it'll be like a playground to shoot the book. And that was totally not the case at all.
So the book is real front and center through all this.
So, and you know, we had to hire more staff. We thought, okay, we got to get this book done. And then we hired, it's called like a chef de cuisine, like a head chef to run the place. So now he's really in charge of the menu. You know, he there's a couple things that are kind of signatures that don't leave, but for the most part, it's, you know, it's his menu. He'll come to us with new dishes, and you know, sometimes I'm a part of them, sometimes I'm not. And that was really for us to be able to finish the book, but also I get to spend more time with my family now and focus. So there's other things, you know, I'm working with some outdoor brands now, some hunting companies, stuff like that, which I love, and I just think like the older I'm getting, the more time I want to spend outside. And it's a really hard struggle for me. Because
yeah, you
I
realize
love,
your time outside is running out at a certain point.
I miss
point.
It. And I get edgy if I don't go into nature once a week or something. Like I'm just, and you know, I want to pass this on to my kids now. And it's really important for me to teach them about hunting and fishing. And now I'm bringing them out into the field more. My daughter has her licenses. You know, my son is itching to get his hunting license when he's 12. And it's really cool.
Do you want your kids to go into to be in chefs and go into restaurant business, or do you advise against doing that?
No, it's whatever makes them happy, right? Like if they want to take on the business or get involved, you know, that's great. If they don't, I totally support whatever they want to do. Because it's a tough business. It's really tough. And it's backwards. You know, you're working when everyone else is off. So it's tough to have a family. It's tough to see your friends. You know, because it's sort of a backwards industry, there's a lot of drugs and alcohol abuse and stuff like that within the industry, and it's a tough one. And it's the financial reward for the amount of hours you put in doesn't pay off for a very long time. You know, people see chefs on TV and they're making tons of money, and it's like, yeah, well, they're also been chefs for their entire lives. You know, and you're as an apprentice, you make minimum wage at best, and you can't make a living off of that, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like I didn't start making a decent paycheck. I think it was like a 10-year mark for me where I made absolute shit for a long time, and then, you know, after 10 or 15 years in the business, I actually got like a decent paycheck and was like, wow, like I'm getting, it was my first head chef job, and it was like, whoa.
That's similar to being a writer.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, you stick with it for a decade.
Yeah.
Before it turns into anything.
Yeah.
Like if you're good.
Yeah.
A lot of people stick with it a decade, never, but very few people launch. It's like, it's a long commitment, man.
Right.
It seems like that's common in the food world. Anything that touches on art.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Exactly. Art. It's like, it's a total artist's type of lifestyle. So it's tough. And yeah, so I support my kids in whatever they want to do. My daughter's, I think she's taking an interest in environmental sciences environmental stuff. And she's looking at a university where, they have a strong like environmental program. So.
Well, man, I hope the vegans leave you alone.
Thank
Sons
you.
Of bitches.
I got to ask before you go, I got to ask about that. You ever noticed that, Steve?
I was noticing it looked like turkey feathers.
Yeah, so I got a turkey wing.
What are we looking at?
I got deer in my antler.
That's the coolest tattoo I've ever seen.
Thanks, man.
Hold on. Let me get a better look. I knew it was turkeys.
So that's a turkey wing.
Oh, you did the whole wing.
And then my wedding band has antler in it, which is neat. And then I got the first buck I shot and tattooed on my neck.
Oh, I got mine on a water bottle. But it wasn't the first one I got.
Yeah. So.
Well, I'll lose that bottle. You're not going to lose that. Let me see that buck again.
So it's actually funny. It's like a 7-pointer and antlers broke. So it's kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. Does your wife like that?
I think she does, yeah.
Did you ask her?
Yeah, I think she likes it, yeah. I had it before I met her, so.
She had no say.
She had no say, yeah.
I wonder what she's, I wish she was here so we could get
next time. I love, like, I flew in and this state's beautiful. So I'm definitely going to have to come back with her and spend more time, so.
Yeah.
Next time. She's into the outdoor lifestyle, so.
Good.
So she'd get along with everybody here.
Good. Well, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope the people leave your restaurant alone. Unless it's good for business, I don't know.
Well, you know.
Maybe they should come back. Head on back over to Antler and protest.
They have left us alone. So, but you know what? The funny thing was we were getting vegans coming in for dinner to support us because they said they didn't want – because we have vegan stuff on the menu. Like it was just so bizarre.
Yeah, I feel like that should be applauded.
Yeah, we welcome everybody. And that's something else I want to say. Like, you know, whether you eat kosher or halal or vegan, like whatever you eat, like you're welcome. And that's what was so bizarre for us was we didn't understand why they singled us out. But yeah.
I'm glad you survived.
Thank you for having me.
That's how I took note of you. I know it's old ass news now, but that's when I was like, wow, that's interesting.
And thank you for your quote in the back of the book.
Oh, yeah. If nothing else, buy the new book. Yeah. Tell people the name of the book. So, we haven't done that.
The book is The Hunter Chef.
Yeah, tell people to buy the book just to read my blurb.
Yeah. Steve Rinella in the back.
Never mind those 100 recipes.
Yeah, and that's so October 6th coming out, but the pre-sale link is I'm going to go up thehunterchef.com June 29th.
Are there way better blurbs than mine?
No, I was very honored by what you wrote, so thank you very much. Yeah. It was very touching.
Are you going to put my blurb on the outside or the inside of the book?
I don't have any say where stuff like that goes.
I find when they bump you off the cover, it's not good.
From what I saw.
When your blurb gets like bumped.
From what I saw, you're actually, I think your quote's on the back cover, like on the outside.
That's
of the
where
back
I want
cover.
It to be. Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Because if they put it on the inside, then you're like, something went wrong. Someone wasn't happy.
Yeah. So thank you very much.
And it goes on sale?
Goes on sale June 29th, thehunterchef.com. There's a pre-sale link, Amazon.
June 29th.
June 29th, the pre-sale link goes up.
Yeah. Oh, but the book ships.
The book ships October 6th is the main release date.
The Hunter Chef.
Just in time for hunting season.
Just in time for hunting season.
You got to send me a bound one.
Okay.
I had the one unbound.
I think you got a digital copy.
No.
Okay.
No. I did. I didn't like it. They sent me an unbound one.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's just too hard for me to picture. I need to like. I'm not creative enough. Yeah. I'm not imaginative enough to.
Oh, you got a bunch of loose pages.
Yeah. I can't. Yeah, no.
You'll get the actual book.
When people want to send digital, I have to.
I don't like reading on.
You need to like hold it.
Yeah.
I can enjoy it, but I can't like really. I gotta just something like that to like give a quote for the book. I was like, I just need to see the damn book, or like kind of like a version of the book. It can't be just me scrolling through PDF files.
Yeah, that's weird. It doesn't make me feel like I'm there, man. E-Kindle stuff.
Yeah,
that's weird.
Anything else, Brody?
Nah, I'm good.
Phil,
thanks for coming.
Phil didn't say nothing.
Phil got his hair cut though.
He did. I like him a lot better.
Speak softly and carry a big stick.
Yeah. Yes, Teddy. Old Teddy.
Bringing it back.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.